Now this is a continuation of the class on Wednesday, ninth week, 28th of May, 69. The governess as Emersonian, largely. This is Channel 2 Over. This is Channel 2 Over and a continuation of the governess as Emersonian, Wednesday of the ninth week.
And then I saw her breathe, and I saw her feel human. So much of our time is nervous, seems to me. Can I read that way? Tense. Huh? That same place there. Now look what happened. It was plump one afternoon in the middle of my very hour. Children were tucked away, and I'd come out for my stroll. One of the thoughts, as I don't in the least shrink from noting, she'll admit it, used to be with me in those wanderings was that it would be as charming as a charming story. Wouldn't that be nice? Someone would appear there at the turn of the path and would stand before me and smile and approve. I didn't ask more than that. I only asked that he should know. The only way to be sure he knew would be to see it, and the kind light of it in his handsome face. I see, isn't that nice? That was exactly present to me, by which I mean the face was, when on the first of these occasions, at the end of a long June day, I stopped short. On emerging from one of the plantations and coming into view of the house. Now, what arrested me on the spot, you see her tone changes? And with a shock much greater than any vision had allowed for, was a sense that my imagination had in a flash turned real. He did stand there. But high up. Beyond the lawn, at the very top of the tower, where little Flora had conducted me that first morning. Now, this tower was one of a pair. Square, incongruous, crenellated. They were distinguished for some reason that I could see little difference as the new and the old. They flanked opposite the end of the building. Now, you know what James does here is put this in to keep from having to say more about Peter Quint. Now, it produced in me this figure. In other words, he makes you feel as if you know more than you actually do, or that he's telling you more than he actually tells you. That's cricket. It produced in me this figure. I don't see how you stand this. In the clear twilight, I remember, two distinct gasps of emotion, which were sharply, how are you going to tell what they are, the shock of my first and then of my second surprise. My second was a violent perception of the mistake of my first. The man who met my eyes was not the person I had precipitately supposed. There came to me this bewilderment of vision of which, after these years, there's no living view that I can hope to give. An unknown man in a lonely place is a permitted object of fear to a young woman privately bred. And the figure that faced me was, a few moments later, as little anyone else I knew as it was the image that had been in my mind. I had not seen it in Hollis Street. I had not seen it anywhere. The place, moreover, in the strangest way in the world, had on the instant and the rare fact of its appearance become a solitude, to me at least, making my statement here with a deliberation with which I have never made it. The whole feeling of the moment returns, and you realize that this is not the little governor speaking now. You're not dealing in this story with a little 20-year-old girl. 18, whatever it was, immature then. But you're dealing with someone who's mature, like Hester and Lygia and those others. You see, it's the governess looking back. The whole feeling of a moment returns. It was as if while I took in what I did take in, all the rest, Dave won't give it a name, all the rest of the scene had been stricken with death. I can hear again as I write the intense hush in which the sounds of evening dropped. The rooks stopped cawing in the golden sky. And this friendly hour lost for the minute all its voice. But there was no other change in nature, unless indeed it was a change that I saw with a stranger sharpness. The gold was still in the sky, the clearness of the air, and the man who looked at me over the battlements was as definite as a picture in a frame. And we were confronted across that space. And you have that first Emersonian inquiry. This thing has happened to her. And she's trying to find out what it is that's happened to her. You don't read Henry James. You're just walking along there, reading along there, and it's just as plain as day, and it's not. You see, all sorts of mental things happen right there in that one little page. Just extraordinary. Now, that's Henry James. It just wearies me just to say how much he can say, how much he thinks, how much alive the man is, you see? Now, look. In 4, the real beginning of fear was one, as I say, well, many days after, it was a queer affair enough. There were hours from day to day, or at least there were moments, such as time when I had to shut myself up to think. It was not so much yet that I was more nervous than I could bear to be, as that I was remarkably afraid of becoming nervous. That's even worse, isn't it? Took little time to see that I could sound without forms of inquiry and without exciting remark in a domestic complication. No, she eliminates that, or James does. The shock I had suffered must have sharpened all my senses. You see, that's what an inquiry does. And you can't go out into the countryside and just look in general. See, the experience has to come to a head. See, that inquiry has to have an object. Or else your mind doesn't work, you know. See, the mind has to take hold. The mind simply has to look for something and take hold before it sees anything. Otherwise, it's just miscellaneous facts. Just clatter, clatter, clatter. Gross have had this packed, haven't they? And they say that they will stick by each other? I kind of forget it. You've just read it now, you remember. In 6, she interprets a little further what has happened, you see. She refers to start with to my dreadful liability to impressions of the order so vividly exemplified. And her companion knows about it, you see. That is, they know they both know that she's been seeing things. Now, the second movement, let's see, the second movement, it was the idea, the second movement, that led me straight out, as I might say, out of the inner chamber. I could take the air. We had gone over and over every feature of what I had seen. He was looking for someone else, you say, someone who was not you. Now, look. This is one of the high points of the book. That's Miss Groves. And she says, "And a portentous clearness now possess me." I see James, or the later governess, is interested in that illumination. And she's trying to analyze it. And she says he was looking for little Miles. That's whom he was looking for. And Mrs. Gross says, "But how do you know?" And she says, "I know, I know, I know. And my exaltation grew." And as you read this, unless your exaltation grows, you haven't read it. "And you know, my dear," now look at that. She didn't deny it, but I required, I felt, not even so much telling as that. She resumed in a minute, at any rate, "What if he should see him? Little Miles, that's what he wants." Now, yes. Oh, this has come to her now, you see, one of her perceptions. She knows what the thing means now. And the ghosts are after the little boy and the little girl. And that defines her purpose at Bly. And that is to be, what does she call it, a screen, a curtain, or something? Huh? Screen between them. In other words, she'll protect the children against the ghosts. So, she's off the deep end now. Watch the children to be sure that the ghosts don't get to them. And you know what happens as soon as she watches the children? Looking for evil, she finds it. So those children that were lovely at first now have their loveliness mixed with suspicion. And that's the governess's pursuit. So that her voices, you see, are from below. Talking along with you, I talked as if I wrote a book, but I didn't. I know very little about it. Just take that one little case. Now, you can do that same thing for long ways. Now, yes, ma'am.
You mean by her voice is her intuition?
Yeah. That's what Emerson used in the shuffle line. That first, second, third paragraph on there. That old friend told him, "But what if these voices are not, you know?" Well, now, just to give it a term, these turn out to be Freudian voices, as James recommended. Internal articles, you see, in your bibliography show you that he is interested in the same thing Freud is at this time. Now, you have this problem, is to use Freud and to bring Freud into the story. And I would like to be sort of pedantic with you on this one point. So, there's a little piece that I got from Eric Fromm. He's talking about the difficulty of everybody. Is on a television, an hour he talked, interviewed for an hour. He said one trouble now is education. Education consisted of so many abstractions, and the students could not convert abstractions into experience. I had a paper. I'll see if I can find it. Annette Maroney wrote it. I'll bring it here and show it to you. That's what she tried to do in that. She tried to take this scenario thesis about the influence of the frontier in American life, American history, And she could never get it out of the technical side. It's still a thesis when she finished with it. Now, that's what happens when you say it's Freudian. We could talk about that for a little while. And all you see that would come up are little tags of thought. Suppressed desires and sex repression. And what else do you associate? The id and something else. None of them, you see, have much. See, Freud sort of underlies all our life and thought these days. And still, it'd be impossible to look at this as a Freudian document. Difficult to do. Number of a class that I've ever had has been able to do it. And I have worked with some right gifted people. Very difficult to do. You say it's Freudian. All right, now what's Freudian about it? I heard a man on Today's show this morning, some technical terms, and think you're getting somewhere, but actually, as far as I can see, they just clutter the mind. Unless a person is able to use them. Let me sort of start you out on this. James set the stage for the Freudian interpretation in the preface or whatever you call it. He gives you the circumstances there. What he does is stack the cards against the governess so she cannot possibly see a way clear to do anything. Now, you remember that? She's 20 years old. She's never had a job. Her education has been neglected. Her pappy wouldn't let her read fiction. What else is wrong with her? They wouldn't let her, huh? Well, that's a disadvantage. See, she's been the oldest daughter. She's had a little bit more sense of responsibility. I didn't realize that. And, he won't let her lean on anybody. It's a Freudian reason that he won't let the master have any contact with her. So that she is isolated. She's got more responsibility than she can handle. And he lets her be infatuated. And if he could find any more ways of dispelling disaster, and bringing on the modern world where we have to make payments the first of every month. Month without end. Yes. You see, you're faced with this whole university that abounds with knowledge and deals it out to you in such extraordinary doses that you've got no idea where you are half the time, and you feel like if the person looks at you straight, your knees will shake. That's how wobbly people are, the faculty and students. So when you come up to me shaking, it just makes me shake that much more. Concerned about your own concerns when I'm just trying to sink or swim, you see, myself. Now that's the modern world. Now what I'm doing is translating an abstraction into experience for you, and you can't do it. You could learn from me a little bit about how to go about it, but most of you won't. And I would say that is more useful than anything else in this term, in here. Oh, it is such a rare thing, you see. To be able to translate abstractions. You know what we do? Our education consists mostly of abstractions. We become so conditioned to them that we prefer them to experience. So that it becomes tedious to read Thoreau. He describes too much, we say. The firebombing, you see, doesn't take place up in Harlem or out yonder all the time. It takes place right at home, the way the mind works. Henry James knew this. I know about the other. I look at it in both ways. Look at it as that marvelous little character that James is just in love with. He treats her so tenderly. Start with. It's so touching how much he feels for her. And he just has to see her go down to perdition. And you don't get that illumination from any university professor or any employee of a state university, state government. You get it from very few. Very few have it. It's a marvelous little story. We'll talk about it a little next time. I've got some of your papers here. Let me tell you, here's just one little bit of business. Yeah, I've read it a good deal. I have to sort of lay it out for you. But actually, after I get through with it, I've actually said so little and covered so little of the ground. You don't even have to repeat what we've said in here. You can just keep it going.
I know, but I wonder if what I wouldn't say would be, you know, pretty.
Just get into it and let it come to you.
You know he's going to chop it down. No.
Yeah, we did nice this morning, didn't we?
Yes. Last time I went out to that pearl, I got shot down so bad it took me all this time to be able to open it again.
Pearl?
Yeah, when I was saying how unchallenged she was one time. Oh, we forgot.
Yeah.
And he put me down so bad, I just sat there, like you said, trembled the
rest. Well, you see, I'm not conscious of that. I ought to be on that.
I don't know if it's so much consciousness of it as, like, I know you want to keep on a train of thought, and I must have deviated from the train of thought that you were trying to follow in class and keep class going.
Well, I didn't have to be rude about it.
Oh, I don't know. You weren't rude about it. It's just, it scares me so much. I'm just like, well, no, that's wrong. And I'm like, wait a minute. Because every time I've been wrong in bringing up a point before, you've like discussed it with me. And this time you said, no, that's wrong. And
I see. Well, you see, I get nervous sometimes. What?
Have you ever read any Sidney Gerard's books?
Well, hell, I haven't read anything hard at all. Why don't you come tell
me? Go on. Now, why do you say things like that? You know better.
I have. Bring one over and tell me about it.
Well, there's something in there that might go with this thing about Freud and the transparent self.
Yeah.
No. And there's another thing in an article in one of these psychological issues. I'll bring
it. Ready?
Yeah.
And come by and talk to me about it. Come in, you know, just a little passage too. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's sort of like an extra. But when we were reading the Scarlet Letter, I've read it like three times before, and I got fascinated, like I do all the time, by Dimmesdale. And I went into an American literature book, and it was just, you know, analyzing what was in the Scarlet Letter. And I was going to do Hester to to the governess for my paper, but I got into it, and it says something where it said Dimmesdale could be compared to the Puritan doctrine, and I pursued that a little bit, and I went out and found out what the Puritan doctrine was, and, you know, that man sins.
What'd you lost? You think you brought it? Sure you brought it?
Yeah, it's all right. Maybe but anyway, so that man sins and
yours, I read one of yours.
Yeah, you want me to put the wrong.
No, just a little bit.
And that he suffers. And then in the end that he has to receive salvation from God. That's the only salvation. And I just thought about how it fits in to Dimmesdale's life. That he did sin with Esther for the Puritan offering. From a Puritan aspect, that he does suffer because he applies forces to himself and the visual, maybe even to self-inflicted. And in the end, he keeps saying, showing towards it, no, the only physician of the soul is God. And he does receive salvation only from God in the end. And I just thought it'd be nice to go through the book and pick out, you know, those phrases and kind of comment on it. And I wondered if you'd take it as an extra paper.
The heart of it, extra paper. Just do that for your paper.
Do you think, or I mean, well, it's not comparing it with any other book.
Well, you'll have to bring the others in order to get into it, you know. Those others give a good light on it. See? But it's
I really don't want to do it as my whole paper. I just wanted to pursue it a little bit.
Yeah, well, yeah, but you, but the, but it's the Dimmesdale that you're really interested in is Emersonian. You've just got to face that. And without that, the other not going to mean anything.
Isn't he more un-Emersonian?
Well, talk with Suzanne about it. She's got into that. Yes, but you, but the high point of it, of Dimmesdale, you see,
yeah.
All that heart of the book there, from the village, I mean from the forest,
yeah.
To return.
Well, that's all of it, about all of it. You can see him taking hold. And they really listen, especially that part of the second governess. And it just occurred to me a while ago, what I actually have asked them to write is an Emersonian paper and let things come to them. And they got to make it logical. Suzanne wrote that long paper on Dimmesdale, and it's wholly logical. It came to her, hit her on the head at 3 o'clock in the morning. She told Faye out here. That certainly didn't get into the paper. Now, she's in the little writing class, and I'm making her do it over again. She's doing it over again. I said, now, it just won't work. I talk with you about writing in one way in here, like Ms. Rawlins, and then in that paper in there, you just write it like an old academic term paper. Unless this is going to have some application, I'm just going to have to disband. And that's the end of this marvelous little session. Wednesday of the ninth week, the 20th of May, 69, the governess as Emersonian. And this is Channel 2 over around 3:20. Channel 2 over around 3:20. And the end of the little session on the governess as Emersonian on Wednesday of the ninth week, 28th of May, 69. This is the next day, Wednesday, Friday of the ninth week. This is the high point. This is the governess as Freudian on Friday, the 30th of May, 69, Memorial Day. My mind never did quite get loose. I labored it, but it was better there than it is here on the tape. And I ran over, laid the whole thing out, and promised to go into the details and make retractions on Monday of the 10th week. Now, you see, this time Florence has helped me a great deal.
Members of the class that are interested and read well, their papers and their quizzes and all still may not be very good. There's a great deal of difference between sort of thinking it and then being able to handle it. Vast difference. Now, I think part of that is what I spoke to you about at the end yesterday, that experience that you get, really, of handling a whole body of thought and getting hold of it in order to use it. I tried to alert you on that at the very beginning. We had a delightful little example of the weight of wealth. Now, that has that 18th century casual manner about it. It doesn't read as if, you see, Franklin is being
Systematic. That's what he does, though. And then to carry that systematic analysis of an 18th century point of view, Prudence, in his autobiography. In other words, to see Franklin as Poor Richard is a sounds easy, but it's a right complex thing. Now you run into the same thing with Emerson. Emerson is a great theorist, you see. Of that, what they call the New England Renaissance, the early, the first half of the 19th century, here in our country. Now his influence, you see, is just unmeasurable. But if you have to face the question, what is his influence, you see? Now, actually, what is Emersonian? You see, that calls forth powers of the mind that is a little hard to come by. You see, you come to the end, and all of that Emersonian world collapses. And if you can see it, it collapses right before your eyes. And this little fragile little thing, the governess, the turn of the screw. Now, in order to see it, a person has to somehow get hold of the term, what James called, in one of the quotations from James, what he called a new psychology. The word Freudian in these circles is used in that same sense. It doesn't have a technical meaning. It has a general meaning and stands for the new psychology. United, long in there. Eric Fromm had this lecture or interview with him. And it's a difficulty America has now, the world has now, an increasing number of people, half the population of the United States, who are dimly aware that something is wrong. That to live in plenty without joy, as Moses said, one should not do. And Edwin Newman says, is there some evidence that Americans feel this way? And he says, not enough patients, statistically speaking, to tell this. But he has lectured to large groups of students, and I look at the people while I speak, look at their faces, and watch what they feel. And I see people rather than listen so much to what they have to say. The miraculous effect of the McCarthy campaign. What draws people to McCarthy is not so much the program as the feeling that here's somebody who stands for life. For peace, who stands against the bureaucratic method, against the use of words, you see, to deceive, that somebody is believable and can be trusted. The movement has already proved that a large number of Americans are thirsty for life, who want another society in which they are not bored, in which life is interesting. Now, that's Fromm's point of view. I'm not particularly interested in that. The student movement is another proof. Students are hungry for life. They want something closer to life than the kind of education they get, which is essentially one of concepts and thoughts. But nothing that is really transformable into living experience, that touches upon living experience. Now, that's where I got the clue, and I was working, you see. I was working in this all the time. And to pursue that, one of the papers that was an extraordinarily fine example of it, a good writer, Annette Moroney, and she's writing about a subject that's very interesting, the
the theory of one of the American historians that what makes us essentially American is this the presence of the frontier in our history. The American character is unique. Now, the first thing is to get hold of the theory and make it and be able to handle it. And she never does that. It is a national in influence and international in recognition. You see, that's the Edward. Americans are a special breed with such acknowledged character traits as Yankee ingenuity, cleverness, inventiveness, and individuality. List. What is it that is peculiar to America and is responsible for the creation, formation, and maintenance of a national character? That's sort of heavy in the wording. Ask a question, sure to go ahead and state it. This is more or less a rhetorical question with many possible answers, and that just tires the brain, you see, waiting for her to get along. The reason she doesn't get along is she doesn't know how. Yet to Frederick Jackson Turner at the University of Wisconsin, there is a unique response. In 1893, in an epical paper entitled The Significance of the Frontier in American History, he attributed the characteristics of the American to his frontier environment. He concluded that the roots of the national character lay not in the European or colonial background, but in the recurring frontiers that have formed the fabric of American history. The frontier environment with its cheap land and free land promoted nationalism, democracy, individualism, all aspects of the national character. Now let me see. That's right. He tries now to picture the national character. With the westward expansion came a confrontation with the problems that prompted the national character traits. As Mark Twain has pointed out to us, the American pioneers were notably the down-and-out society. America was populated by brokes and persecuted Europeans. Thus, the initial conflict was to live on the fringe of society rather than in it. As the margin of civilization moved from east to west, the real frontiersman moved still farther west. The land he cultivated was virgin, untenable, and crawling with Indians who resented and resisted him as an intruder. At first, the only law was the principle of survival of the fittest, and the frontiersman was found to be rugged, hardy, highly individual, with negligible methods of transportation and communication. The restless settlers were isolated from those around them, and they developed extreme self-sufficiency and unequal inventive genius. The man himself became a loner with little or no concern for the social graces, so much a part of the European heritage. Although a people on the move do not notably alter their mores, geography does become the selector of their cultural patterns. Now, that's, you see, if you're grading that, you know, according to their standards, that works pretty well. She doesn't have a hold of the subject. But her instinct is good again. She shows the beginning of this American character and uses this, you know, the fine portrait in Crèvecoeur, written around 1800. And with about equal success. Let me just suggest to you how it would work out. Actually, a picture of an American. This picture of an American who has that feeling for the frontier. Now, this is just a little few sentences from Mark Twain's Roughing It at the beginning of that chapter in which he has the cowardly yarn. Now, you like. Now, he doesn't state anything abstractly, but it's understood. This Turnerian thesis, some such thing. He's going across country, you see, on that coach, stagecoach. Another night of alternate tranquility and turmoil. But morning came by and by. It was another glad awakening to fresh breezes, vast expanses of level greensward, bright sunlight, an impressive solitude utterly without visible human beings or human habitations, and an atmosphere of such amazing magnifying properties that trees that seemed close at hand were more than 3 miles away. We resumed undress uniform, climbed the top of the flying coach, dangled our legs over the side, shouted occasionally at the frantic mules, merely to see them lay their ears back and scamper faster, tied our hats on to keep our hair from blowing away, and leveled an outlook over the worldwide carpet about us for things new and strange to look at. Even at this day, it thrills me through and through to think of the life, the gladness, and the wild sense of freedom that used to make the blood dance in my veins on those fine overland mornings. George Frederick Jackson Turner himself ever did that. I think he made the statement and then sort of just turned it over and over in terms of some historical data. What Henry James does. This is the accordion of the new psychology. He stacks, as I said to you, he stacks against the cards against the governess in that opening. He does two things there. He vouches for her. She was a most charming person. Remember that little passage. So that the reader has to keep that in mind all through the disasters of the story. He puts in all those circumstances. She's young, inexperienced. Comes from this deprived upbringing, has it? She's never read Amelia. You know what Amelia is. She does something that is absolutely unsuspected by any reader that I have ever run into. In Poe, in the Castro Montalato, he states a thesis. That's what revenge is. He ventured on insult. He vowed revenge and then defined revenge. Does the same thing. The very first statement that the governess makes. Now that's in that Mark chapter 1. So for 1890, or at this preliminary stage, you see, of the new psychology, this passage for scientific statement. I remember the whole beginning as a series of flights and drops, a little seesaw of the right throbs and the wrong. I can use our technical language, so we pass over that, I presume. The flights and drops, what do you call those? Depressions and what's the opposite? Exhilarations? Elevation. And you, what do you call it when you do that? They have cycles, don't we call it? Well, this is the same thing, except it's not just cycles. Don't people, adults, happen to? A statement. Now, that first section or so has to be read as an elaboration of that statement. It's a thesis statement, you see. The thesis is followed by this example. After rising in town to meet the master, she had a couple of very bad days, she calls it. That's the very beginning. She found herself doubtful again. She thinks that she's made a mistake, and in that frame of mind, she spent the long hours of bumpings
of the bumping swinging coach to Bly. And then she was met by a commodious fly, and driving in that lovely afternoon, you see, her fortitude is mounts a bit, but it's still up and down. Now, she says she had no drop again until the next day when the letter about Miles arrived. It preceded him, remember? And the very first thing, she overreacts to Flora, as we said, and to the grounds, the large, impressive room. So, you see, that's not a normal reaction. That comes from her state of mind. She watches from my open window the faint summer dawn. To look at such portions of the rest of the house, like Gross says, the little boy is a remarkable tool. And the governess says, to Miss Gross says, you will be carried away by the little gentleman. And the governess says right off, well, I think that is what I came for, to be carried away. You see, that adds to the thesis that she's complicating her trouble. The next day, she feels only a slight oppression, depression, produced possibly, she thinks, by fuller realization of her good fortune. And little Flora is her guide all over the place, you know. And in the last sentence, she feels it is like the first day had been, on the whole, as I have expressed, reassuring, but I was to see it wind up in keen apprehension. Now, this is the letter. She broke the great seal. She took it up to her room and only attacked it before going to bed. I had better have let it wait till morning, for it gave me a second sleepless night. With no counsel to take the next day, I was full of distress, and it finally became so, the better of me, I determined to open myself at least to Mrs. Gross. Now, you see what she does? She even takes, that's the most alarming thing, that as part of it. That's still her background. That's an extraordinary jolt. The little boy, the other child, has been dismissed from school. Now, you see, you watch her respond. Mrs. Gross gave me a look that I remarked at the moment. And then she showed genuine tears. What does the letter say? It says the boy will be an injury to the others, and pretty soon she interprets that as contaminating the others. Now, that's her state of mind. You see, she's building it up. Mrs. Gross says, see him first, then believe it. And that leads into the governess watching the boy with his deep question in her mind. So you see, the cards were stacked to start with. It's just building up against her. And it was the beginning of the curiosity that was to widen in the next hours into pain. She sees the little boy in the great glow of freshness, the same, this is number three, the same positive fragrance of purity in which I had seen his little sister. He was incredibly beautiful. He had that indescribable little air of knowing nothing in the world but love. And that leads into the first pact with Mrs. Gross. Gross says, what are you going to do about it? She says, nothing. That is, she won't tell the master. And they will see it out. And Mrs. Gross says this, then I'll stand by you. We'll see it out. And they kiss and embrace like sisters. Now, that's put in a healthy manner. It's the unhealthy mind of the reader that doubts that. Because it was a time so full that she is conscious of the art she needs to make it seem real. Recalls and understands her situation, and this is a restatement of the thesis. What I look back at with amazement is the situation I accepted. She was charmed by the master and proposing to see it out. I was lifted aloft in a great wave of infatuation and pity. See, this is, of course, you see, this is, you see the same elevation that you get in Hester. It's always there. It's always present. What you've got into. And then there's the garden scene, you see, in which he sees Peter Quinn. Now, I think it's in 4, isn't it, where we were talking about last time? You see, she looks closely at what happens. The picture comes back to me. So you see, you know, it's not the simple governess. She's looking back at it. Now, that in itself is Emma Stone inside of it. She's looking at it, back at it, as experience. And she is not something just objectionable that she shuts out of her mind. You see, as you find from the new psychology, that's one of the easiest things to do, or just, what do you call it, just get it out of your mind. And block it out. That's the new psychology, you might say. But now that's the Emersonian view, is to keep it as experience and examine. The next interview there, he's in chapter 6, you know, to the to that basic perception. Basic perception. I don't know how you quite think how you take the Freudian view of that. She's already, you see, she is in the process. This is final, not the final touch, but this pretty well defines her inquiry. She'll protect the children to win the approval of the master, but she has to watch them. And she's looking for, now her inquiry, you see, leads her to all the discoveries. But it's the nature of inquiry, you see, that causes her undoing. She looks for evil, and she has to find it. Look for it, you see. It happens in that same chapter 6. And the very first thing the governess notices when they're out on the ground, that the children contrive to let me alone without appearing to drop me. Charming quality that they have. Might say it's about the first suspicion. Let you last event that leads up to that. It's deception on the part of both of them, the children. Last for a good while. Miss Jessel is on the other side of the lake. And the governess with Miss Gross and the little girl are on this side. That's a long time. Page 2. Where Miss is waiting for the others to show that they see Miss Jessel. So stood before us on the opposite bank exactly as she had stood the other time. And I remember strangely as the first feeling now produced in me my thrill of joy at having brought on approval. She was there, and I was justified. She was there, and I was neither cruel nor mad. She was there for poor, scared Miss Gross. But she was there most for Flora. And no moment of my monstrous time was perhaps so extraordinary as that in which I consciously threw out of her an inarticulate message of gratitude out to her. She rose erect on the spot my friend and I had lately quitted, and there was not in all the long reach of her desire an inch of her evil that fell short. This first vividness of vision and emotion were things of a few seconds, during which Mrs. Gross's dazed blink across to where I pointed struck me as the sovereign sign that she too at last, just as it carried my own eyes precipitately to the girl, you see. Now, I won't read that. Without a convulsion of her small pink face, she's looking at Flora now to watch the signs by Flora observing, admitting it. without a convulsion of her small pink face, not even feign to glance in the direction of that prodigy I announced, but only instead of that turn at me an expression of hard, still gravity, an expression absolutely new and unprecedented, and that appeared to read and accuse and judge me. This was a stroke that somehow converted the little girl herself into the very presence that could make me quail. I quailed, even though my certitude that she thoroughly saw was never greater than at that instant. Now, that's an intense thing. And you see, she brings the report. Miss Gross also, and Beth Thornbury to reckon with. My elder companion, the next moment, then rate, blotted out everything but her own flushed face and her loud, shocked protest, a burst of high disapproval. What a dreadful turn, to be sure, miss. Where on earth do you see anything? See, with Mrs. Gross doubting or denying, I felt my own situation horribly crumble. Kerwet says our companion on this. We know, don't we? She isn't there, little lady, and nobody's there, and you never see nothing, my sweet. How can poor Miss Jessel, when poor Miss Jessel's dead and so on? Now, our companion on this had responded with a strange, quick primness of propriety, and they were again, with Mrs. Gross on her feet, united, as it were, in pain opposition to me. Flora continued to fix me with her small mask of reprobation. And even at that minute, I prayed God to forgive me for seeming to see that as she stood there holding tight to our friend's dress, her incomparable childish beauty had suddenly failed, had quite vanished. I've said it already. She was hideously hard. She had turned common and almost ugly. I don't know what you mean. I see nobody. I see nothing. I never have. I think you're cruel. I don't like you. Then after this deliverance, which might have been that of a vulgarly pert little girl on the street, she hugged Mrs. Gross more closely and buried in her skirts a dreadful little face. In this position, she produced an almost furious wail. Take me away. Take me away. Take me away from her. So she turns on the governess. All you can do is to say what happens. Now, what I would say to you, the specialist in this, what I want to do, I want to amend my approach to it, if you can help me. I would say, what I would make about it is this, that any statement on this, any explanation about what happens here that uses technical language of psychiatry won't fit. It will thwart everything. Be like the pendulum, under the pendulum thing. A whole body of extraordinary, abnormal behavior that's put in all the books. A good bit of that, here's the part now I want to recognize. A good bit of that extraordinary behavior in here. Put too much, if he puts very much, It'll make it a case study. Handbook, you see. Those patients from the normal are so serious. You see, you just couldn't maneuver it. Or could write a little paper, a study of this, the aberrations that James is conscious of and puts in here. If he does, it'll spoil the study for him. I wouldn't recommend it. He doesn't ought to be conscious of that. His mind on something else. Painful. Now, use. I didn't intend to all talk. Use a non-technical word. Technical word, but it's adopted in general. If the term prudence gets in your way, you can break it down.
Personian ideas get in your way, you can just put them in other words.
But the thing is about technical people is they can't use other words. And then when literary or general students get into the technical side of it, they can't convert them either. You reach an impasse here where the whole civilization, you see, is at the mercy of language. One word that you can understand and that will account for everything that happens here is a word that you use all the time.
and it's perfectly satisfactory. You'd have to add to it in the latter part of the story. Chapter 20, count for it. The simple word, anxiety.
Such a simple word. Family and a home for soon. It's up in the C3 book. A family should have a home of its own seems like a truism to which almost every American would assent without further thought. Most Americans also accept the fact that we have a housing shortage as a consequence of a failure to build in the 30s and during World War II, and of discrepancy
that we need more houses. Nobody can live in a house anymore except the man and his wife and their children.
Home. Excluded from it the grandmother, the unmarried sister, the unmarried daughter, as part of the same process of repudiating any sharing of the home with another adult, domestic servant has vanished. We have multiplied the number of homes in which the whole life of the family has to be integrated each day, meals cooked, lunches packed, children bathed, doors locked, dogs walked, cat put out, food orders, washing machines set in motion, flowers sent to the sick, birthday cakes baked, pocket money sorted, mechanical refrigerators defrosted. Where one large pot of coffee used to do, now it has to be individual pots cooked to the recipe of each order of each member of the family.
That little world crumbled. Man, all that society has made for him,
he has a good job. Well,
one thing gets him.
To be promoted every year. Got to make more money this year than he made last. He doesn't.
He might as well come out there in the country and live with me. What I call the world in which we all live. Psychology now pertains. Anxiety is the quality that's built into our system. Institutions are all traps. It looks such a cure-all. And there's something like this that Margaret Mead talks about. And the joy can vanish. It's just taxing, you see, all the time. What I won't do, it takes two. Absolutely no end of improvements that have to be made. Necessarily, the person goes off the deep end. But he never has that balance. What is it Carl Becker says Franklin always had? A reserve that gave him, what was that quality? Above the moment.
It is right on our steps all the time.
Life is unheard of. No one can read more than 3 pages on one subject, and that is rare. Our life as we see it. I'm trying to do convert these abstractions, as we've used all term, into experience. The governess analyzes way of life, one in which Hester and Ishmael cannot flourish. She does that. She enables us to see the predicament that we are in. And understanding it is half the battle. All the governess had to do was herself to withdraw, loose. And let go some of those extraordinary responsibilities that she was taking on, she's not equipped to take on. Our fortress, as Luther might call it, fortress. The Burg is unser Gott. The knowledge of what experience is, as you see it in Ishmael. Ishmael looked right into all those difficulties and those personal problems you see on the Pequot. Is that the name of it? He even faced the abyss, the axle of the universe, with Ahab. He could see it. There's all those little tags of thoughts like that. I don't understand all those.